this time ain't gonna heal me. You and I know that's true. Yeah, this time slowly gonna kill me. Oh, that's time without you.
The Austin Chronicle has said of my next guest, Dale Watson saves country music every day and night with one honky-tonk two-step after another. But after a 20-year career in which he recorded hundreds of original songs, Dale Watson went into semi-retirement. But now he's back with not one but two albums, From the Cradle to the Grave from Hyena Records and the Little Darlin' Sessions from Koch. And I'm very pleased that he could join us to talk about both of them and tell the story about how he ended his break from music with a recording session in a rather unusual place. Hi, Dale.
Hi, Leonard. Thanks for having me on.
Did you have a chance to play music for yourself, at least, during the time that you were out of the business?
No, not really. It was a short hiatus, but it was for a purpose. You know, I didn't know how long it would be, really. I didn't know if it would be permanent or not. It was more important that my kids, my two daughters, moved to the East Coast, at Baltimore, and from Texas, and then that was having a hard time for me, and so I just want to make sure if they're going to make that move with their mother that I got them in a good place, a good house, and it was a good neighborhood.
But you didn't miss it at all. Benny Golson, who's a famous jazz musician, said he just stopped liking the sound that he was creating, and he went into composing, and he did very well. He wrote a lot of movies and a lot of television shows. But then one day he said he missed it, picked up the sax, and it was different.
Yeah, well, that definitely revitalized my love for it, you know. But I was pretty involved in what I was doing, and I certainly missed music and missed performing and missed doing the road. It's hard I'd imagine to be like a truck driver who just stopped driving one day. You know, it's really hard. Inertia does kick in.
Did you intend to come back to the music?
My plan was what I shot for. My goal was to be gone for about 6 months and then come back. Luckily, that happened. It was about 7 months, but close enough to the goal. But I was prepared just to take as long as it takes to get my kids settled. My kids are so resilient. You know, it happened within months.
But you came back with a bang. You recorded this album in the Tennessee Mountains, in a cabin that had great significance.
That's true, but it wasn't a planned recording. Obviously we recorded it and planned on to record it that way, but I never planned on it being the next record out. I do a lot of recording of records that because I want to do them, and it's not because a record company says, "Hey, we want you to go in here and do this record." It's more of I guess you'd call them vanity projects, you know. And that's how this came about. A friend of mine, Johnny Knoxville, the actor, owns it. He bought it from Johnny Cash.
And this is the famous cabin in the woods that was featured in the movie?
Well, it not that's in the movie, but it's the actual cabin, but it's not the one that's in the movie, if that makes any sense.
Well, no, it's the one that they were trying to
Well, he owned several cabins, so I don't really know if that was the first one he bought or not.
Had he put a recording studio in there?
Nope. It was just a bare bones cabin, but it wasn't roughing it by any means either. He had central air, and you know, but he built it to live in, you know. He moved out of it, he let his daughters and nieces live there. But you walk in there, you definitely feel the air of Johnny Cash, because I've said many times, you know, I've been lucky enough to been around Mr. Cash, and you didn't ever have to see him walk in a room. You felt him walk in a room, and so that same feeling was in that cabin.
I'm sure you saw him perform quite a bit. What about him seeing you perform?
Yeah, that was my first time I ever met him. I was performing for Rosemary Clooney for her head injury foundation. I'm a little embarrassed. I don't remember the name of it. It has a proper name, but I was just one of many, many artists on it. On the bill, Ray Charles was. Ray Charles, Hal Ketchum, Trisha Yearwood. It was a star-studded night, hosted by Ralph Emery, and I was asked to do Roger Miller. There was five people being presented with awards that night, and Johnny Cash was one of them. for their songwriting. You know, Johnny Cash, Buck Owens, Harlan Howard, Hank Cochran, and positively with Roger Miller. So everybody was doing these different people's songs, and I was asked to do a Roger Miller medley. And so I was in the middle of it. I knew one song very well. I do it through the years. But the other one, Chug-a-Lug, was new to me, and I was started into the to the transition. I could not remember the first line. And always, I've done this since I've started playing music. Obviously, got this from Johnny Cash. Was whenever I forgot the words, I would just hum. That's why I did the humming. Johnny Cash said in interviews that he did it just to get on key, on pitch. But I did it to buy me some time to think of words.
Although there's a long tradition in gospel music called moaning, where you just do that.
And that's
true. Of course,
true.
Jazz, it's scat singing, but it's pretty much the same.
Well, I was just using it to buy me some time and get my thinker going. And luckily it did. I remembered it. But then I thought to myself, oh, my God, there is Johnny Cash and his wife June sitting right there, and I did that. I was a little embarrassed. And they came up and got the awards, and I thought, well, this is a good time to get my picture of all these guys, and he grabbed me by the shoulder and he said, June, he said, here he is. I says, son, my name is Johnny Cash. I'd like to introduce you to my wife. I said, I know who you are, sir. He said, y'all, you made my our night tonight whenever you did that, because Roger Miller was her closest friend. He said, and June started saying, yes, we miss him so much. And when you did that, that's what Roger would do to tell us hi, let us know that.
You didn't know that.
I had no idea. And he said, we just thought it was a spiritual way of Roger saying hi, and they grabbed each other's hand. So that made me feel really great.
So you had to set up a studio in this cabin, Johnny Cash's cabin.
Right. And like that fell into place, too. A friend of mine, Kelly Stewart and Charlie Boswell over at AMD Processors, they heard me on the phone talking to Johnny Knoxville, and I was asking him about the studio. He said, there is no studio. I said, oh, okay. I'll just go up there and hang out then. Well, Charlie said, man, we'd love to come up there and record. I said, so great. AMD was on this thing where they're promoting live recording, so it worked out.
I'm talking with Dale Watson, and he has two albums coming out, From the Cradle to the Grave on Hyena Records and The Little Darlin' Sessions from Koch Records. The cover of From the Cradle to the Grave has a tombstone with the words Country Music R.I.P., So right. Do you really think that country music is dead or just dying?
No, I think the definition of country music is dead. Whenever you say country music, I used to be very proud that when people asked me what kind of music I do, I'd say country. And there was no confusion on what that meant. I grew up listening to George Jones and Ray Price and Merle Haggard and all these guys, Johnny Cash, and I think you can hear it in my music. I think its influences are that way. And today, when you say country music, people automatically think of the Kenny Chesney, Faith Hills, whatever. I'm not downing them at all. There's nothing wrong with that. I'm just saying it doesn't apply to me. The definition doesn't apply to me or my music and most of the people that are tour around with me.
Because it's so much more like pop music.
Yeah, today's
But country music has always had this kind of Tin Pan Alley side, hasn't it?
Always. Every.
Where professional songwriters wrote songs for singers to sing, produced by somebody else. And you're somebody who sings mostly your own material. So you
True.
Grow out of a different tradition, the Hank Williams, Hank Snow, whatever tradition.
Right, but there was always a watchman on guard in the industry. You know, there was always someone to say, hey, look, that's not country. You belong over there, you know. and all that is just sorting out. It's not being mean or mean-spirited. It's just sorting out. You don't want to mix your oranges, with your apples. You know, it's just you want the taste that you got the taste for.
Well, some people say that radio has killed country music because most radio stations don't want to play real country music anymore.
You know, mainstream radio has killed country, but the industry itself has turned into a snake that's biting its own tail. It's really devouring itself and devouring its young. It's doing it solely for the dollar and not for the integrity of the music. And I know that's a strong statement, but I really feel that way, that it's being run by businessmen instead of music.
Well, you knew you were being provocative when you put that tombstone on the cover of
the CD. I'm not worried about offending anybody in the industry there, because there's a lot of friends in the machinery that are trying to help along. It's only because silence is a form of consent, you know. When you come out with something that that sounds like Faith Hill's music sounds more like Celine Dion, it should be in that category. I am not by any means condemning it. I'm just saying it doesn't belong on a country station.
You wrote or co-wrote all the songs on the CD while you were in the cabin?
Right.
Now, how much can I assume that the songs grow out of your own life? How autobiographical are they?
Probably about 95%.
Because one of the songs, for example, Time Without You,
right,
seems to refer pretty explicitly to an earlier tragedy in your life.
Exactly. See, now, here's the thing. I did write 10 songs while I was in the cabin. I included two that I'd written previously, like Yellow Mama. I'd written in 97 when the electric chair was actually still in Huntsville. And Time Without You I'd written during that time when I lost my girlfriend to a tragic car accident.
Well, the year 2000 brought a double dose of tragedy for you, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I tried to kill myself right after that, right after her, and then in 2002 I was committed to the mental institution, you know.
And that all worked out okay?
I got married Sunday, May 5th, and life is all anew. I found a wonderful lady who helped me heal.
The film director Zaman King made a documentary about your experiences in the mental institution called Crazy Again.
Crazy Again, right. There's a song on another album that came out last year called Whisker of God that is entitled Crazy Again, and that's probably what – there's a book coming out next year. It'll probably be that same title.
Isn't something like that a mixed blessing? On the one hand, it's a terrible thing to go through. On the other side, it brings you a lot of publicity in country music where it's hard to get publicity sometimes.
Well, I think what it does is really it's not something that you want to plan, but at least it's something that you got a platform where people can identify with you, because there's a mental health is a big issue in everybody's life, but I don't think it's something you really want to depend on your publicist for.
Obviously, you don't want to go through it just to get a little newspaper coverage.
Exactly.
Some of our staff here still remember seeing you open for Merle Haggard.
Oh,
at
what
Tramps.
A great night that was for me.
And you also cite Johnny Cash, as you have been, and his lyrics in Runaway Train. What about some of the other influences?
Well, Merle Haggard, I think, like I said, if people are influenced by somebody, you should be able to hear it in their music, and definitely you should be able to hear Merle Haggard in my music because he's a huge influence. And that's one of the things that really does irritate me about some of the artists that are coming out and say they're influenced by Merle and George Jones and Johnny Cash, and then they sound more like Elton John or something like that, and there's nothing wrong with that, but it's like it'd be like me saying I'm on a diet of nothing but
But how did that happen? Diet. How did that happen for you? Because you grew up during a time when rock was the dominant musical style. I'm sure the same as they did. And what they're trying to do is merge a little bit of the country music tradition with all the rock that they grew up with. How come you didn't wind up playing like Led Zeppelin or Pink Floyd or something?
Well, my dad played music for a living, and he played his music around the house, and I liked it. You know, I was a rebellious teenager, but not in the way of his music. I enjoyed it, and I took to it, and what ended up happening that way was his influences became my influences.
You have a second CD coming out, The Little Darlin' Sessions. And on it, you do 15 of Johnny Paycheck's early songs that he recorded with Aubrey Mayhew. How did that come about?
It came about because Nick Hunter, who worked with Aubrey Mayhew in the early 70s, who was producer of all the Little Darlin' Sessions, asked me if I wanted to sing with Aubrey producing. And this is actually a tragic Nashville story. And I'll make it very quick.
Well, let's go back and explain that Little Darlin' is a a record label. That was Aubrey Mayhew's record label, and it had a sound that was loud in your face, but at the same time still sounds like it could have been recorded yesterday. And we're talking about records from the 60s mostly.
Right, exactly. And their biggest artist was Johnny Paycheck, and who was also an influence of mine. But it was I thought it was going to be a really great experience because Lloyd Green is one of my favorite steel guitarists ever, and all of them guys, the musicians that were on them sessions were pretty much the same guys. And we were going to do that, but all the producer wanted to do was use songs that he had the publishing on. And that's the way it was in the 60s. You know, the artists didn't have any say-so on what came out. And as a result, what I was hoping that record would be didn't make it. The musician, we recorded it and didn't even get a chance to fix some of the things that were wrong with it. A lot of times I was reading the lyrics on a paper, and they'd say, okay, that's good enough, let's move to the next song.
Wow, I always thought that artists at least had a little bit of control and were able to say, well, let's do another take.
Lloyd Green told me later, he said,
your name goes on it.
Right. Lloyd Green told me later that it wasn't never that bad as it was this recording session. But thankfully, Hyena is going to let me go in with Lloyd Green, and we're going to co-produce together a new album of my originals and a couple of covers with these same guys.
Now, you have all originals on From Cradle to Grave except one, which you co-wrote with Gail Davis, who is one of the most famous country songwriters, and also Chuck Mead.
Chuck Mead from BR-549, right.
So was that because you just couldn't get that song together yourself, or did you want to collaborate?
No, when I knew I was going to go up there and write, because, you know, writing an album's worth of songs was a little intimidating, and I didn't want to go up there with these preconceived songs. I wanted to write the songs there. So I asked a bunch of friends out there in Nashville to come up to the cabin, but they were the ones that did, and I'm glad they did. Gail Davies, Chris Scruggs, and
we're going to go out with that song, You Always Get What You Always Got, right, from the album From the Cradle to the Grave on Hyena Records. Thank you so much, Dale Watson, for being with us today.
Leonard, thanks for having me.
Don't you know what you're doing is bound to fail? You're a puppy dog chasing the same old tail. The bass is different, but the heart remains the same old love with a brand new name. You're burning the candle at both ends, son. When you gonna learn that the fire is hot? If you always do what you've always done, you'll always get what you always got.